This is Audible.
The Magos and the Definitive Casebook of Gregor Eisenhorn. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. Pestilence. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. The archenemy infects this universe. If we do not pause to fight that infection here, within our own selves, what purpose is there in taking our fight to the stars? Apothecary Endgame, from his treatise on Imperial Medicine. 1. It is my belief that memory is the finest faculty we as a species possess. Through the function of memory, we are able to gather, hone, and transmit all manner of knowledge for the benefit of mankind, and the endless glory of our God Emperor, may the Golden Throne endure forevermore. To forget a mistake is to be defeated a second time, so we are taught in the sermons of Thor. How many a great leader plan his campaign without memory of those battles won and lost before? How many his soldiers absorb his teaching and improve without that gift? How many the ecclesiarchy disseminate its message to the universal populace without that populace holding the teachings in memory? What are scholars, clerks, historians, or chroniclers but agencies of memory? And what is forgetfulness but the overthrow of memory? The ruination of precious knowledge, and an abhorrence. I have, in the service of His Exalted Majesty, the Emperor of Terra, waged war upon that abhorrence all my life. I strive to locate things forgotten and return them to the custody of memory. I am a scrabbler in dark places, an illuminator of shadows, a turner of long unturned pages, an asker of questions that have lapsed, forever hunting for answers that would otherwise have remained unvoiced. I am a recollector, prizing lost secrets from the taciturn universe and returning them to the safe fold of memory, where they might again improve our lot among the outflung stars. My particular discipline is that of materia medica, for human medicine was my original calling. Our understanding of our own vital mechanisms is vast and admirable, but we can never know too much about our own biology and how to protect, repair, and improve it. It is our burden as a species to exist in a galaxy riven by war, and where war goes, so flourish its handservants, injury, and disease. It may be said that as each war front advances, so medical knowledge advances too. And where armies fall back in defeat or are destroyed, so medical knowledge retreats or is forgotten. Such are the lapses I seek to redress. Upon that very purpose I came to Symbol Iota late in my 48th year, looking for Ebo. To provide context, let me say that this would be the 3rd year of the Geovingian campaign in the Obscura Segmentum, and about 9 sidereal months after the first outbreak of Ulran's pox among the guard legions stationed on Geovingia itself. Also known colloquially as blood froth, Ulran's pox was named after the first victim it took, a color sergeant called Gustav Ulran of the 15th Morian, if memory serves me, and I pride myself it does. As a student of imperial history and materia medica too, you will have Ulran's pox in your memory. A canker of body and vitality. Virulently contagious, it corrupts from within, thickening circulatory fluids and wasting marrow, while embellishing the victim's skin with foul cysts and buboes. The cycle between infection and death is at most 4 days. In the later stages, organs rupture, blood emulsifies and bubbles through the pores of the skin, and the victim becomes violently delusional. Some have even conjectured that by this phase, the soul itself has been corroded away. Death is inescapable in almost every case. It appeared without warning on Genovingia, and within a month the Medicae Regimentalis were recording 20 death notices a day. No drug or procedure could be found that began to even slow its effects. No origin for the infection could be located, Worst of all, despite increasingly vigorous programs of quarantine and cleansing, no method could be found to prevent wholesale contagion. No plague carriers or means of transmission were identifiable. As an individual man weakens and sickens, so the Imperial Guard forces as a whole began to fail and falter as their best were taken by the pestilence. Within 2 months, War Master Rheingold's staff were doubting the continued viability of the entire campaign. By the 3rd month, Ulrin's pox had also broken out, apparently miraculously and spontaneously, given its unknown process of dispersal, on Genovingia Minor, Lorchis, and Adamanaxa Delta. 4 separate centres of infection, right along the leading edge of the Imperial advance through the sector. At that point, the contagion had spread to the civilian population of Genovingia itself, and the Administratum had issued a proclamation of pandemic. It was said the skies above the cities of that mighty world were black with carrion flies, and the stench of biological pollution permeated every last acre of the planet. I had a bureaucratic posting on Lorchis at that time, and became part of the emergency body charged with researching a solution. It was weary work. I personally spent over a week in the archive without seeing daylight, as I oversaw the systematic interrogation of that vast, dusty body of knowledge. It was my friend and colleague, Administra Medica Leonid Vammel, who first called our attention to Pyridae and the Torment. It was an admirable piece of work on his part, a feat of study, cross-reference and memory. Vammel always had a good memory. Under the instruction of Senior Administrator Medica Junus Malta, we diverted over 60% of our staff to further research into the records of Pyridae, and requests were sent out to other Genovingian worlds to look to their own archives. Vammel and I compiled the accumulating data ourselves, increasingly certain we had shone a light into the right shadow and found a useful truth. Surviving records of the Torment incident on Pyridae were painfully thin, though consistent. It was, after all, 34 years in the past. Survivors had been few, but we were able to trace 191 possibles who might yet be alive. They were scattered to the 4 cosmic winds. Reviewing our findings, Senior Malta authorized personal recollection, such was the gravity of the situation, and 40 of us, all with rank High Administrator or better, were dispatched immediately. Vammel, rest his soul, was sent to Gandian Saturnalia, and was caught up in a local civil war, and thereafter killed. I do not know if he ever found the man he was looking for. Memory is unkind there. And I was sent to Symbol Iota. 2. Symbol Iota, where it is not covered in oceans that are the most profound mauve in colour, a consequence, so I understand, of algae growth, is a hot, verdant place. Rainforest islands ring the equatorial region in a wide belt. I made fall at Symbolopolis, a flat-topped volcanic outcrop, around whose slopes hive structures cluster like barnacles, and there, transferred to a trimaran, which conveyed me, over a period of 5 days, down the length of the local island group to St. Bastion. I cursed the slowness of the craft, though in truth it skated across the mauve seas at better than 30 knots, and, on several occasions, tried to procure an ornithopter, or air conveyance. But the Cymbali are a nautical breed who place no faith in air travel. It was torturous, and I was impatient. It had taken 10 days to cross the Imperium from Lorchis to Symbol Iota aboard a navy frigate. Now it took half that time again to cross a distance infinitesimally smaller. It was hot, and I spent my time below decks, reading data slates. The sun and sea wind of Symbol burned my skin, used as it was to years of lamp-lit libraries. I took to wearing a wide-brimmed straw hat above my administrator's robes whenever I ventured out on deck, a detail my servitor Caliban found relentlessly humorous. On the 5th morning, St. Bastion rose before us out of the violet waters, a pyramidal tower of volcanic flue, dressed in jungle greenery. Even as we crossed the inlet from the trimaran to the shore by electric launch, turquoise seabirds mobbing over our heads, I could see no discernible sign of habitation. The thick coat of forestation came right down to the shore, revealing only a thin line of white beach at its hem. The launch pulled into a cove where an ancient stone jetty jutted out from under the trees like an unfinished bridge. Caliban, his bionic limbs whirring, carried my luggage onto the jetty and then helped me over. I stood there, sweating in my robes, leaning against my staff of office, batting away the beetles that circled in the stifling humidity of the cove. There was no one there to greet me, though I had voxed word of my approach several times en route. I glanced back at the launch pilot, a dour Cymbali, but he seemed not to know anything. Caliban shambled down to the shore end of the jetty and called my attention to a copper bell, verdigreed by time and the oceans, that hung from a hook on the end of the pier. "Ring it," I told him, and he did, cautiously, wrapping his simian fingers against the metal dome. Then he glanced back at me, nervously, his optical implants clicking under his low brow ridge as they refocused. Two sisters of the Ecclesiarchy shortly appeared, their pure white robes as stiff and starched as the bicorn wimples they wore on their heads. They seemed to regard me with some amusement, and wordlessly ushered me to follow them. I fell in step behind them, and Caliban followed, carrying the luggage. We took a dirt path up through the jungle, which rose sharply and eventually became stepped. Sunlight flickered spears of light through the canopy above, and the steaming air was full of exotic birdsong and the fidget of insects. At a turn in the path, the hospice of St. Bastian Apostate suddenly stood before me. A great stone-built edifice typical of the early imperial naive, its ancient flying buttresses and lower walls were clogged with vines and creepers. I could discern a main building of 5 stories, an adjacent chapel, which looked the oldest part of the place, as well as outbuildings, kitchens, and a walled garden. Above the wrought-iron lich gate stood a weathered statue of our beloved god-emperor smiting the arch-enemy. Inside the rusty gate, a well-tended path led through a trimmed lawn, punctured by tombstones and crypts. Stone angels and graven images of the Adeptus Astartes regarded me as I followed the sisters to the main door of the hospice. I noticed then, fleetingly, that the windows of the 2 uppermost stories were rigidly barred with iron grills. I left Caliban outside with my possessions and crossed the threshold behind the sisters. The main atrium of the hospice was a dark and deliciously cool oasis of marble, with limestone pillars that rose up into the dim spaces of the high vault. My eyes lighted on the most marvellous triptych at the altar end, beneath a stained glass oriel window, which I made observance to at once. In breadth it was wider than a man's spread arms, and showed 3 aspects of the saint. On the left, he roamed the wilderness in apostasy, renouncing the demons of the air and fire. On the right, he performed the miracle of the maimed souls. In the center panel, his martyred body, draped in blue cloth, the 9 bolter wounds clearly countable on his pallid flesh, he lay in the arms of a luminous and suitably mournful emperor. I looked up from my devotions to find the sisters gone. I could feel the subliminal chorus of a psychic choir mind-singing nearby. The cool air pulsed. A figure stood behind me, tall, sculptural, his starched robes as white as his smooth skin was black. He seemed to regard me with the same amusement that the sisters had shown. I realized I was still wearing my straw hat. I removed it quickly, dropping it onto a pew, and took out the pict slate of introduction Senior Malta had given me before I left Lorch's.
"I am Baptrice," he said, his voice low and genial. "Welcome to the Saint's Hospice."
"Higher Administrator Medica Lemuel Sark," I replied. "My dedicated function is as a recollector, posted lately to Lorch's. Genovingia General Group 4577 Decimal, as part of the Campaign Auxiliary Clerical Archive."
"Welcome, Lemuel," he said. "A recollector, indeed. We haven't had one of your breed here before."
I was uncertain quite what he meant, though in hindsight the detail of his misunderstanding still chills me. I said, "You were expecting me? I voxed messages ahead."
"We have no voxcaster here at the hospice," Baptrice replied. "What is outside does not concern us. Our work is focused on what is inside. Inside this building, inside ourselves. But do not be alarmed. You are not intruding. We welcome all who come here. We do not need notice of an arrival."
I smiled politely at this enigmatic response and tapped my fingers on my staff. I had hoped they would be ready for me, and had everything in place so that I could begin my work immediately. Once again, the leisurely pace of Cymbal Iota was weighing me down. I must, Brother Baptiste, proceed with all haste. I wish to begin my efforts at once.
He nodded. Of course. Almost all who come to St. Bastian are eager to begin. Let me take you through and provide you with food and a place to bathe.
I would rather just see Ebbo, as soon as it's possible. He paused, as if mystified.
Ebbo?
Colonel Feig Ebbo, late of the 23rd Landmark Lancers. Please tell me he is still here, that he is still alive.
He is,
Baptiste faltered, and looked over my picked slate properly for the first time. Some sort of realization crossed his noble face.
My apologies, Higher Sark. I misconstrued your purpose. I see now that you are an acting recollector, sent here on official business.
Of course, I snapped. What else would I be?
A supplicant, coming here to find solace. An inmate. Those that arrive on the jetty and sound the bell are always that. We get no visitors except those who come to us for help.
An inmate, I repeated.
Don't you know where you are? He asked. This is the hospice of St. Bastian. A refuge for the insane.
3. An asylum. Here was an inauspicious start to my mission. I had understood from my research that the hospice of St. Bastian was home to a holy order that offered sanctuary and comfort for those brave warriors of the Emperor's legions who were too gravely wounded or disabled by war to continue in service. I knew the place took in the damaged and the lost from war zones all across the sector, but I truly had no notion that the damage they specialized in was wounds to the psyche and sanity. It was a hospice for the deranged, individuals who presented themselves at its gates voluntarily in hope of redemption. Worst of all, Baptiste and the sisters had presumed me to be a supplicant. That damned straw hat had given me just the air of madness they were expecting. I was lucky not to have been unceremoniously strapped into a harness and placed in isolation. On reflection, I realize I should have known. Bastian, that hallowed saint, was a madman who found sanity in the love of the Emperor, and who later cured, through miracles, the mentally infirm. Baptiste pulled a bell cord, and novitiates appeared. Calibane was escorted inside with my luggage. We were left alone in the atrium as Baptiste went to make preparations. As we waited, a grizzled man with an old tangle of scar tissue, where his left arm had been, crossed the hall. He was naked save for a weathered, empty ammunition belt strung around his torso. He looked at us dimly, his head nodding slightly. Then he padded on his way and was lost from view. Somewhere, distantly, I could hear sobbing, and an urgent voice repeating something over and over again. Hunched at my side, his knuckles resting on the flagstones, Caliban glanced up at me anxiously, and I put a reassuring hand on his broad, hairy shoulder. Figures appeared around us, haggard, tonsured men in long black ecclesiarch vestments, and more phantom sisters in their ice-white robes and horned cowls. They grouped in the shadows on either side of the atrium and watched us silently. One of the men rehearsed silently from long ribbons of parchment that a boy-child played out for him from a studded casket. Another scribbled in a little chapbook with his quill. Another swung a brass censer around his feet, filling the air with dry, pungent incense. Baptiste reappeared.
Brethren, be welcome to Higher Administrator Sark, who has come to us on official business. You will show him every courtesy and cooperation.
What official business?
Asked the old priest with the chapbook, looking up with gimlet eyes. Magnifying half-moon lenses were built into his nasal bone, and rosary beads hung around his dew-lapped neck like a floral victory wreath. A matter of recollection, I replied.
Pertaining to what?
He pressed.
Brother Jadon is our archivist, Higher Sark. You will forgive his persistence.
I nodded to Baptiste and smiled at the elderly Jardone, though no smile was returned. I see we are kindred, Brother Jardone. Both of us devote ourselves to remembrance. He half shrugged.
I am here to interview one of your inmates.
It may be that he holds within some facts that even now may save the lives of millions in the Genovingian group. Jardone closed his book and gazed at me, as if waiting for more. Senior Malta had charged me to say as little as I could of the pandemic, for news of such a calamity might spread unrest. But I felt I had to give them more. Warmaster Rheingold is commanding a major military excursion through the Genovingian group. A sickness, which has been named Ulrun's Pox, is afflicting his garrisons. Study has shown it may bear comparison with a plague known as the Torment, which wasted Pyridi some 3 decades past. One survivor of that epidemic resides here. If he can furnish me with any details of the incident, it may be productive in securing a cure.
How bad is it, back on Genovingia?
Asked another old priest, the one with the censer. It is contained, I lied. Jardone snorted.
Of course it is contained. That is why a higher administrator has come all this way. You ask the most foolish things, Brother Girod.
Another man now spoke. He was older than all, crooked and half-blind, his wrinkled pate dotted with liver spots. A flared ear-trumpet clung to the robes of his left shoulder with delicate mechanical legs.
I am concerned that questioning and a change to routine may disturb the serenity of the hospice. I do not want our residents upset in any way.
Your comment is noted, Brother Nero, said Baptrice. I'm sure Hyasak will be discreet.
Of course, I assured them. It was late afternoon when Baptrice finally led me upstairs into the heart of the hospice. Calibane followed us, lugging a few boxed items from my luggage. Ghostly, Bicorn's sisters watched us from every arch and shadow. We proceeded from the stairs into a large chamber on the third floor. The air was close. Dozens of inmates lurked there, though none glanced at us. Some were clad in dingy, loose-fitting overalls, while others wore ancient fatigues and imperial guard dress. All rank pins, insignia, and patches had been removed, and no one had belts or bootlaces. 2 were intently playing regicide on an old tin board by the window. Another sat on the bare floor planks, rolling dice. Others mumbled to themselves or gazed into the distance blankly. The naked man we had seen in the atrium was crouching in a corner, loading spent shell cases into his ammunition belt. Many of the residents had old war wounds and scars, unsightly and grotesque.
Are they safe?
I whispered to Baptrice.
We allow the most stable freedom to move and use this common area. Of course, their medication is carefully monitored. But all who come here are safe, as all who come here come voluntarily. Some, of course, come here to escape the episodes that have made regular life impractical.
None of this reassured me. On the far side of the chamber, we entered a long corridor, flanked by cell rooms. Some doors were shut, bolted from outside. Some had cage bars locked over them. All had sliding spy slits. There was a smell of disinfectant, an ordure. Someone, or something, was knocking quietly and repeatedly against one locked door we passed. From another we heard singing. Some doors were open. I saw 2 novitiates sponge-bathing an ancient man who was strapped to his metal cot with fabric restraints. The old man was weeping piteously. In another room, where the door was open but the outer cage locked in place, we saw a large, heavily muscled man sitting in a ladder-back chair, gazing out through the bars. He was covered in tattoos, regimental emblems, mottos, kill scores. His eyes glowed with the most maniacal light. He had the tusks of some feral animal implanted in his lower jaw, so they hooked up over his upper lip. As we passed, he leapt up and tried to reach through the bars at us. His powerful arm flexed and clenched. He issued a soft growl.
"Behave, Ayok," Baptrice told him.
The cell next door to Ayok's was our destination. The door was open, and a sister and a novitiate waited for us. The room beyond them was pitch black. Baptrice spoke for a moment with the novitiate and the sister. He turned to me.
"Ebo is reluctant, but the sister has convinced him it is right that he speaks with you. You may not go in. Please sit at the door."
The novitiate brought up a stool, and I sat in the doorway, throwing out my robes over my knees. Calibane dutifully opened my boxes and set up the transcribing artificer on its tripod stand. I gazed into the blackness of the room, trying to make out shapes. I could see nothing.
"Why is it dark in there?"
"Ebo's malady, his mental condition, is exacerbated by light,"
He demands darkness.
Baptiste shrugged. I nodded glumly and cleared my throat. By the grace of the God Emperor of Terra, I come here on his holy work. I identify myself as Lemuel Sark, Higher Administrator Medica, assigned to Lorch's Administratum. I glanced over at the Artificer. It chattered quietly and extruded the start of a parchment transcription tape that I hoped would soon be long and informative. I seek Feig Ebo, once a colonel with the 23rd Lamech Lancers. Silence. Colonel Ebo? A voice, thin as a knife, cold as a corpse, whispered out of the dark room.
I am he. What is your business?
I leaned forwards. I wish to discuss Pyridy with you, the torment you endured.
I have nothing to say. I won't remember anything.
Come now, Colonel. I'm sure you will if you try.
You misunderstand. I didn't say I can't. I said I won't.
Deliberately.
Just so. I refuse to.
I wiped my mouth and realized I was dry-tongued. Why not, Colonel?
Pyridy is why I'm here. 34 years trying to forget. I don't want to start remembering now.
Baptiste looked at me with a slightly helpless gesture. He seemed to be suggesting that it was done, and I should give up. Men are dying on Genovingia from a plague we know as Ulrin's Pox. This pestilence bears all the hallmarks of the torment. Anything you can tell me may help save lives.
I couldn't then. 59,000 men died on Pyridy. I couldn't save them then, though I tried with every shred of my being. Why should that be different now?
I gazed at the invisible source of the cold voice. I cannot say for sure, but I believe it is worth trying. There was a long pause. The Artificer whirred on idle. Calibane coughed, and the machine recorded the sound with a little chatter of keys.
How many men?
I'm sorry, Colonel. What did you ask me?
How many men are dying?
I took a deep breath. When I left Lorchus, 900 were dead, and another 1,500 infected. On Genovingia Minor, 6,000 and twice that number ailing. On Adabanaxa Delta, 200. But it had barely gone there. On Genovingia itself, 2.5 million. I heard Baptiste gasp in shock. I trusted he would keep this to himself. Colonel? Nothing. Colonel, please. Cold and cutting, the voice came again, sharper than before.
Pyridy was a wasted place.
4.
Pyridy was a wasted place. We didn't want to go there, but the arch-enemy had taken the eastern continent and razed the hives, and the northern cities were imperiled. Warmaster Getus sent us in. 40,000 Lamarck Lancers, virtually the full strength of the Lamarck regiments. 20,000 Fansho armor men and their machines, and a full squad of Adeptus Astartes. The Doom Eagles, shining grey and red. The place we were at was Pyridy Polar. It was God knows how old. Cyclopean towers and columns of green marble, hewn in antique times by hands I'm not convinced were human. There was a strangeness to the geometry. The angles never seemed quite right. It was as cold as a bastard. We had winter dress, thick white flak coats with fur hoods, but the ice got in the lasguns and dulled their charges, and the damned Fansho tanks were forever refusing to start. It was day, too. Day all the time. There was no night. It was the wrong season. We were so far north. The darkest it got was dusk, where one of the two suns set briefly, and the sky turned flesh pink. Then it would be daylight again. We'd been on and off for 2 months, mainly long-range artillery duels, pounding the ice drifts. No one could sleep because of the perpetual daylight. I know two men One a Lamakine, I'm not proud to say, who gouged out his eyes. The other was a Fanshawe. Then they came. Black dots on the ice floes, thousands of them, waving banners so obscene they... Whatever. We were in no mood to fight. Driven mad by the light, driven to distraction by the lack of sleep, unnerved by the curious geometry of the place we were defending, we were easy meat. The forces of chaos slaughtered us and pushed us back into the city itself. The civilians, about 2 million strong, were worse than useless. They were pallid, idle things with no drive or appetite. When doom came upon them, they simply gave up. We were besieged for 5 months, despite 6 attempts by the Doom Eagles to break the deadlock. Faith, but they were terrifying. Giants, clashing their boulders together before each fight, screaming at the foe, killing 50 for every one we picked off. But it was like fighting the tide, and for all their power, there were only 60 of them. We called for reinforcements. Getus had promised us, but now he was long gone aboard his warship, drawn back behind the fleet picket in case things got nasty. The first man I saw fall to the torment was a captain in my 7th platoon. He just collapsed one day, feverish. We took him to the Pyridae Polar Infirmium, where Subjunctus Valis, the apothecary of the Doom Eagles Company, was running the show. An hour later, the captain was dead. His skin had blistered and bubbled. His eyes had burst. He had tried to kill Valis with a piece of the metal cot he had torn from the wall brace. Then he bled out. You know what that means? His entire body spewed blood from every orifice, every pore. He was a husk by the time it was over. In the day after the captain's death, 60 fell victim. Another day, 200. Another day, 1,000. Most died within 2 hours. Others lingered for days. Pustular, agonized. Men I had known all my life turned into grisly sacks of bone before my eyes. Damn you, Sark, for making me remember this! On the 7th day, it spread to the Fanshawe as well. On the 9th, it reached the civilian population. Valis ordered all measure of quarantine, but it was no good. He worked all hours of the endless day trying to find a vaccine, trying to alleviate the relentless infection. On the 10th day, a Doom Eagle fell victim. In his torment, blood gouting from his visor grills, he slew 2 of his comrades and 19 of my men. The disease had overcome even the Adeptus Astartes purity seals. I went to Valis, craving good news. He had set up a laboratory in the infirmium, where blood samples and tissue scrapes boiled in alembics and separated in oil flasks. He assured me the torment would be stopped. He explained how unlikely it was for a pestilence to be transmitted in such a cold clime, where there is no heat to incubate and spread decay. He also believed it would not flourish in light. So he had every stretch of the city wired with lamps, so there would be no darkness. No darkness. In a place where none came naturally, even the shadows of closed rooms were banished. Everything was bright. Perhaps you can see now why I abhor the light and cling to darkness. The stench of blood filth was appalling. Valis did his work, but still we fell. By the 21st day, I'd lost 30% of my force. The Fanshawe were all but gone. 12,000 Perodian citizens were dead or dying. 6 Doom Eagles had succumbed. Here are your facts, if you want them. The plague persisted in a climate that should have killed it. It showed no common process of transmission. It brooked no attempt to contain or control it, despite efforts to enforce quarantine and cleanse infected areas with flamers. It was ferociously contagious. Even Space Marine purity seals were no protection. Its victims died in agony. Then, one of the Doom Eagles deciphered the obscene script of one of the Chaos banners displayed outside the walls. It said one word. One filthy word. One damned, abominable word that I have spent my life trying to forget.
5. I craned in at the dark doorway. What word? What word was it, Colonel? With great reluctance, he spoke it. It wasn't a word at all. It was an obscene gurgle, dignified by consonants. The glyph name of the plague demon itself. One of the 97 blasphemies that may not be written down. At its utterance, I fell back off my stool, nausea writhing in my belly and throat. Caliban shrieked, the sister collapsed in a faint, and the novitiate fled. Baptiste took 4 steps back from the doorway, turned, and vomited spectacularly. The temperature in the corridor dropped by 15 degrees. Unsteady, I attempted to straighten my overturned stool and pick up the artificer that the novitiate had knocked over. Where it had recorded the word, I saw the machine's parchment tape had begun to smoulder. Screaming and wailing echoed down the hall from various cells. And then, Iok was out. Just next door, he had heard it all, his scarred head pressed to the cage bars. Now that cage door splintered off its mount and crashed to the corridor floor. Berserk, the huge ex-guardsman thrashed out and turned towards us. He was going to kill me, I'm certain, but I was slumped and my legs wouldn't work. Then Caliban, bless his brave heart, flew at him. My devoted servitor rose up on his stunted hind limbs, the bionics augmenting his vast forelimbs, throwing them up in a warning display. From splayed foot to reaching hand, Caliban was 11 feet tall. He peeled back his lips and screeched through bared steel canines. Froth dribbling from his tusked mouth, Iok smashed Caliban aside. My servitor made a considerable dent in the wall. Iok was on me. I swept my staff of office around and thumbed the recessed switch below the head. Electric crackles blasted from the staff's tip. Iok convulsed and fell. Twitching, he lay on the floorboards and evacuated involuntarily. Baptiste was on his feet now. Alarms were ringing, and novitiates were rushing frantically into the corridor with harness jackets and clench poles. I rose and looked back at the dark doorway. Colonel Ebo! The door slammed shut. 6. There would be no further interview that afternoon, Brother Baptiste made plain, despite my protests. Novitiates escorted me to a guest chamber on the second floor. It was whitewashed and plain, with a hard wooden bed and small scriptorium table. A leaded window looked out onto the graveyard and the jungles beyond. I felt a great perturbation of spirit, and paced the room as Caliban unpacked my belongings. I had come so close, and had begun to draw the reluctant Ebo out. Now, to be denied the chance to continue when the truly dark secrets were being revealed. I paused by the window. The glaring crimson sun was sinking into the mauve oceans, throwing the thick jungles into black, wild relief. Seabirds reeled over the bay in the dying light. Stars were coming out in the dark blue edges of the sky. Calmer now, I reflected that whatever my internal uproar, the uproar in the place itself, was greater. From the window I could hear all manner of screams, wails, shouts, banging doors, thundering footsteps, rattled keys. The word of blasphemy that Ebo had spoken had thrown all the fragile minds in this house of insanity into disarray, like red-hot metal plunged into quenching cold water. Great efforts were being made to quieten the inmates. I sat at the teak scriptorium for a while, reviewing the transcripts, while Caliban dozed on a settle by the door. Ebbo had made particular mention of Subjunctus Valis, the Doom Eagle's apothecary. I looked over copies of the old Pyridae debriefings I had brought with me, but Valis's name only appeared in the muster listings. Had he survived? Only a direct request to the Doom Eagle's chapter house could provide an answer, and that might take months. The Adeptus Astartes are notoriously secretive, sometimes downright blatant in their uncooperative relationship with the Administratum. At best, it might involve a series of formal approaches, delaying tactics, bargaining. Even so, I wanted to alert my brethren on Lorches to the possible lead. I damned Saint Bastian when I remembered the place had no Voxcaster. I couldn't even forward a message to the astropathic enclave at Symbolopolis for transmission off-world. A sister brought me supper on a tray. Just as I was finishing, and Caliban was lighting the lamps, Nero and Jardone came to my chamber. "Brothers?" Jardone got right to it, staring at me through his half-moon lenses.
"The Brotherhood of the Hospice have met, and they decided that you must leave tomorrow. No further audiences will be granted. We have a vessel that will take you to the fishing port at Math Island. You can obtain passage to Symbolopolis from there."
"I am disappointed, Jardone. I do not wish to leave. My recollection is not complete."
"It is as complete as it's going to be," he snapped.
"The hospice has never been so troubled,"
Nero said quietly.
"There have been brawls. 2 novitiates have been injured. 3 inmates have attempted suicide. Years of work have been undone in a few moments."
I nodded. "I regret the disturbance, but—"
"No buts," barked Jardone.
"I'm sorry, Hyasark,"
said Nero.
"That is how it is."
I slept badly in the cramped cot. My mind, my memory, played games, going over the details of the interview. There was shock and injury in Ebbo, that was certain, for the event had been traumatic. But there was something else, a secret beyond anything he had told me, some profound memory. I could taste it. I would not be deterred. Too many lives depended on it. Caliban was slumbering heavily when I crept from the chamber. In the darkness, I felt my way to the stairs and up to the 3rd floor. There was a restlessness in the close air. I moved past locked cells where men moaned in their sleep or muttered in their insomnia. At intervals, I hugged the shadows as novitiate wardens with lamps made their patrol. It took perhaps 3/4 of an hour to reach the cell block where Ebbo resided. I stalked nervously past the bolted door of Iok's room. The spy slit opened at my touch.
"Ebbo."
"Colonel Ebbo," I called softly into the darkness.
"Who?"
His cold voice replied. "It is Sark. We weren't finished."
"Go away."
"I will not, until you tell me the rest."
"Go away,"
I thought desperately, and eagerness made me cruel. "I have a torch, Ebbo. A powerful lamp. Do you want me to shine it in through the spy hole?" When he spoke again, there was terror in his voice. "Emperor, forgive me for my manipulation."
"What more is there?"
he asked.
"The torment spread. We died by the thousand. I cannot help your cause, though I pity those men on Genovingia."
"You never told me how it ended."
"Did you not read the reports?"
I glanced up and down the dark cell block to make sure we were still alone. "I read them. They were sparse. They said Warmaster Getus incinerated the enemy from orbit, and ships were sent to relieve you at Pyridae Pola. They expressed horror at the extent of the plague loss. 59,000 men dead. No count was made of the civilian losses. They said that by the time the relief ships arrived, the torment had been expunged. 400 men were evacuated. Of them, only 191 are still alive, according to the records."
"There's your answer, then."
"No, Colonel. That's no answer. How was it expunged?"
"We located the source of infection. Cleansed it. That was how."
"How, Ebbo? How in the God Emperor's name?"
"It was the height of the torment. Thousands dead."
7.
"It was the height of the torment. Thousands dead. Corpses everywhere. Pus and blood running in those damnably bright halls. I went to Valis again, begging for news. He was in his infirmium, working hard. Another batch of vaccines to try, he told me. The last six had failed, and had even seemed to aggravate the contagion. The men were fighting themselves by then, killing each other in fear and loathing. I told Vallis this, and he was silent, working at a flame burner on the steel workbench. He was a huge being, of course. Adeptus Astartes, a head and a half taller than me, wearing a cowled red robe over his Doom Eagle's armor. He lifted specimen bottles from his Narthesium and held them up to the ever-present light. I was tired. Tired like you wouldn't believe. I hadn't slept in days. I put down the flamer I had been using for cleansing work and sat on a stool. "Are we all going to perish?" I asked the great apothecary. "Dear, valiant Ebbo," he said with a laugh. "You poor little man. Of course not. I will not allow it." He turned to face me, filling a long syringe from a stoppered bottle. I was in awe of him, even after the time we had spent together. "You are one of the lucky ones, Ebbo. Clean so far. I'd hate to see you contract this pestilence. You have been a faithful ally to me through this dark time, helping to distribute my vaccines. I will mention you to your commanders." "Thank you, apothecary." "Ebbo," he said, "I think it is fair to say we cannot save any who have been infected now. We can only hope to vaccinate the healthy against infection. I have prepared a serum for that purpose, and I will inoculate all healthy men with it. You will help me, and you will be first, so I can be sure not to lose you." I hesitated. He came forwards with the syringe, and I started to pull up my sleeve. "Open your jacket and tunic. It must go through the stomach wall." I reached for my tunic clasps and saw it. The tiniest thing. Just a tiny, tiny thing. A greenish-yellow blister just below Vallis's right ear.
8. Ebbo fell silent. The air seemed electrically charged. Inmates in neighboring cells were thrashing, restless, and some were crying out. At any moment, the novitiate wardens would come. "Ebbo," I called through the slit. His voice had fallen to a terrified whisper, the whisper of a man who simply cannot bear to put the things haunting his mind into words. "Ebbo!" Keys clattered nearby. Lamplight flickered under a hall door. Iok was banging at his cell door and growling. Someone was crying. Someone else was wailing in a made-up language. The air was ripe with the smell of feces, sweat, and agitated fear. "Ebbo!" There was no time left. "Ebbo, please!"
Vallis had the torment. He'd had it all along, right from the start.
Ebbo's voice was strident and anguished. The words came out of the slit as hard and lethal as Laz fire.
"He had spread it. He, through his work, his vaccines, his treatments, he had spread the plague. His mind had been corrupted by it. He didn't know what he was doing. His many, many vaccines had failed because they weren't vaccines. They were new strains of the torment bred in his infirmium. He was the carrier, a malevolent, hungry pestilence clothed in the form of a nobleman, killing thousands upon thousands upon thousands."
I went cold, colder than I'd ever been before. The idea was monstrous. The torment had been more than a waster of lives. It had been sentient, alive, deliberate, planning and moving through the instrument it had corrupted. The door of Iok's cell was bulging and shattering. Screams welled all around, panic and fear in equal measure. The entire hospice was shaking with unleashed psychoses. Lamps flashed at the end of the block. Novitiates yelled out and ran forward as they saw me. They would have reached me had not Iok broken out again, rabid and slavering, throwing his hideous bulk into them, ripping at them in the frenzy. "Ebbo!" I yelled through the slit. "What did you do?" He was crying, his voice ragged with gut-heaving sobs.
"I grabbed my flamer.
Emperor, have mercy. I snatched it up, bathed Valis with flame. I killed him. I killed him. I slew the pride of the Doom Eagles. I burned him apart. I expunged the source of the torment.
A novitiate flew past me, his throat ripped out by animal tusks. His colleagues were locked in a desperate struggle with Iok. You burned him?
Yes. The flames touched off the chemicals in the infirmium, the sample bottles, the flasks of seething plague water. They exploded. A fireball. Oh, gods! Brighter than the daylight that had never gone away. Brighter than... fire everywhere. Liquid fire. Flames around me. All around. Oh! Oh!
Bright flashes filled the hall, the loud discharge of a las weapon. I stepped back from Ebo's cell door, shaking. Iok lay dead amid the mangled corpses of three novitiates. Several others, wounded, whimpered on the floor. Brother Jardone, a las pistol in his bony hand, pushed through the orderlies and ecclesiarchs gathering in the hall and pointed the weapon at me.
I should kill you for this, Sark! How dare you!
Baptrice stepped forwards and took the gun from Jardone. Nero gazed at me in weary disappointment.
See to Ebo,
Baptrice told the sisters nearby. They unlocked the cell door and went in.
You will leave tomorrow, Sark,
Baptrice said.
I will file a complaint to your superiors.
Do so, I said. I never wanted this, but I had to reach the truth. It may be, from what Ebo has told me, that a way to fight Ulrin's pox is in our reach.
I hope so,
said Baptrice, gazing bitterly at the carnage in the hall.
It has cost enough.
The novitiates were escorting me back to my room when the sisters brought Ebo out. The ordeal of recollection had killed him. I will never forgive myself for that, no matter how many lives on Genovingia we saved. And I will never forget the sight of him, revealed at last in the light. 9. I left the next day by launch with Caliban. No one from the hospice saw me off or even spoke to me. From Math Island, I transmitted my report to Symbolopolis, and from there, astropathically, it lanced through the warp to Lorches. Was Ulrin's pox expunged? Yes, eventually. My work assisted in that. The blood froth was like the torment, engineered by the arch-enemy, just as sentient. 52 medical officers, sources just like Valis, were executed and incinerated. I forget how many we lost altogether in the Genovingia group. I forget a lot these days. My memory is not what it was, and I am thankful for that, at times. I never forgot Ebo. I never forgot his corpse, wheeled out by the sisters. He had been caught in the infirmium flames on Pyridipola. Limbless, wizened like a seed case, he hung in a suspensor chair, kept alive by intravenous drains and sterile sprays. A ragged, revolting remnant of a man. He had no eyes. I remember that most clearly of all. The flames had scorched them out. He had no eyes, and yet he was terrified of the light. I still believe that memory is the finest faculty we as a species own. But, by the Golden Throne, there are things I wish I could never remember again. That was Pestilence, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Master Imus's Transgression, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth.
I suppose,
he sniffed,
you get a lot of cases like mine.
The officer did not reply. In the 10 minutes since Master Imus had been received, the officer had made very few remarks, except to announce his credentials and ask a few general questions. Master Imus had presented himself, of his own volition, at the portico of the dark, unfriendly building late that afternoon. He had been invited to wait in an anteroom off the inner yard. The anteroom was cold and forlorn. The fretful fingers of individuals previously invited to wait there had marked the white plaster with a greasy patina, and pacing feet had worn the wooden floor. There were no windows, but light poked in through a trio of dingy filters. From outside, far away, Master Imus could hear the street noises of workers flooding home to their habs and their evening meals.
Master Imus sat in one of the old wooden chairs provided. A clerk attended him first. The clerk led Master Imus through to a side office, panelled in dark wood, and sat him at a small desk. The clerk was hunched over with the weight of the stenogram built into his chest. He sat on a stool, handed Master Imus a form, and told him to read out the questions printed on it and answer them in his own words. As Master Imus spoke, haltingly at first, the clerk's birdfoot hands pecked the keys of the stenogram and recorded his comments. The stenogram clattered like an adding machine, a sound that made Master Imus feel exceptionally sad. When the form was completed, the clerk left the office and was replaced, after a few minutes, by a second clerk. The second clerk led Master Imus into a chamber that smelled of machine heat and was cluttered with banks of whirring cogitators. The second clerk examined Master Imus's papers and copied them on one of the cogitators. Several versions of Master Imus's biographical particulars flashed up on the multiple screens for a moment, and then faded into a dull green glow. This slow, silent dissolution of all he was seemed unpleasantly symbolic to Master Imus. He was taken back to the anteroom and left alone again. The daylight was ebbing. A small lamp had been lit in his absence. Master Imus waited for 20 minutes, and then the officer arrived. "Johann Imus?" the officer asked as he entered the room, reading from a data slate. Master Imus stood up.
"That's me, sir,"
he said. The officer was a tall, well-made man with dark hair. He was dressed, and this came as no surprise to Johann Imus, in black clothes and a black leather coat. The officer looked Master Imus up and down with unforthcoming eyes, and announced his credentials with a cursory wave of his rosette. "You have been received for inspection. Follow me, please," he said. Master Imus followed him obediently. He followed him across the twilit yard, in through an archway, and up an endless flight of varnished stairs. The officer opened a door and ushered Master Imus into a small room. The room had a large ornamental fireplace that looked as if it had not seen a fire in centuries. A gilt clock ticked on the mantel. There was a rug on the wooden floor, and two plain chairs on either side of a desk. An armchair stood in one corner, a comfortable and friendly item of furniture that Master Imus never got to sit in. They took their seats on either side of the desk. "What is the nature of the crime you are confessing?" the officer asked, after studying the data slate for a few minutes.
"Not a crime as such,"
Master Imus replied hastily.
"No?"
"A transgression. Yes, a transgression. That is a better word altogether."
"The nature of the transgression, then?"
"I have already explained this," Master Imus offered, "to the clerk."
The officer scrolled back through the slate's files. "Have you borne false witness to this statement as I read it?"
"No, sir."
"Were you coerced, invited, or urged to make this report?"
"No, sir,"
Master Imus said.
"I have come here of my own volition. I said as much."
"That is noted here strenuously. You made that point several times during the preliminary examinations."
"I simply wanted it to be clear," said Master Imus. "I was persuaded to come here by my own conscience, nothing else."
The officer was silent for a moment. "You say you have been suborned by the ruinous powers, drawn into their evil, and set upon an unholy task." Master Imus nodded.
"I suppose,"
he sniffed,
"you get a lot of cases like mine." "Everything must be held carefully to account," stated Johann Imus. "I am an indentured bookkeeper and a citizen of Imperial Hesperus, the latter an honour I hold even more dear than my work at Slosha and Daviov et Si. My father was keeper of books for Slosha and Daviov, and his before him. My work, like theirs, involves the enumeration of company accounts, the allocation of funds, the scrutiny of audits, and the day-to-day upkeep of financial income and outgoings. I have held my post for 62 years, and run a department of 18 underkeepers. No, I have no wife, no kin to speak of. My work is my life. Slotcher and Daviov, an illustrious auction house. Surely you've heard of it. Well, it maintains offices in the Garcel Commercia, just off the place 14th Jaumier. In the main, we deal with antique furnishing, silks, samiter ware, brashine mannequins, and fine arts. The sale rooms are on Varsensen Street, beside the lifter depot. There are open fair sales every mains day, and specialist auctions every other sole day.
Occasionally we hold irregular fetes for particular customers or particular treasures. Last Gorgon's Day we offered a list that included 8 small ooze-like busts by Sambriano Celci and a series of human eeks from the Jokero ruins on Tornish. No, sir, I am no connoisseur. My salary does not provide me with the funds to collect or speculate, but funds are my business. I am painstaking and exact in my work. I would never wish to cause Master Slosher or Master Davyov professional embarrassment by misplacing a decimal point or wrongly adding a column of figures. This is why I have come. I do not make mistakes. Ah, well, now you ask, we come to the meat of it, I suppose. Last Solde, I set out to review the quarterly accounts. The year-end looms, and the imperial tithe statements must be turned correctly. I found an error. Well, not an error so much as an aberration. Something that could not be accounted for. It was an idle annoyance at first, but the more I studied the pages of the ledger, the more peculiar it became. There was a void, you see. A void, a gap or empty place in the flow of the accounts that defied explanation. It was as if a page or two were missing from my ledger. No, not at all. This was the master ledger. Only I had access to it. Sir, you belittle my craft with such a question. I keep books, and I have kept books my whole life. I am a creature of accuracy. It was not simply a matter of a creeping error, a stray subtotal. There were figures missing. Simply missing. And yet, a page or two on, the books balanced, seamlessly, as if there had been no hole. This is what I mean by the word void. Numbers are my language, my life. I know when they are lying. There was a void in the accounts, and the more I struggled to identify it, the more the figures hid it from me. It was as if they were closing ranks to conceal the truth. Why have I come to you with a bookkeeping error? Sir, again, you mock me. It was no error. I reviewed and recalculated. I redid the accounts 8 times. As I added to this column and subtracted from that, the numbers began to betray me. They became numbers that I did not understand. Sir, I believe I have calculated something that should not be. I believe I have found the number of ruin.
He regarded Master Johann Imus for a moment. Such a small man, shriveled by age, his sparrow bones lost in heavy robes that had evidently been cut to fit his father or his grandfather. The gilt clock ticked on the mantel. Its face had no hands, a simple ordo trick. The constant measured ticking was all that mattered. Tock, 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 flicking time away without a trace of its passage on the enameled face. Guilt got them all in the end. Imus possessed a small, neat face with a wide-slit mouth that might have revealed a toothy grin had the circumstances been different. His hair was straggly and white, and he wore half-moon eyeglasses. His knuckles bulged with arthritis. "The number of ruin?" asked the officer. Imus nodded.
"That is my transgression. Will it be painless?"
"Will what be painless?" Imus struggled.
"My punishment. I presume, well, censure is inadequate. Will it be burning? Poison?"
The officer had been making notes in a small copybook. He dipped his pen into the desk's power well. "Do you believe you have committed a crime, sir?" he asked.
"No, no, not at all. But I believe I have become a crime. I am a criminal thing."
"I see." Master Imus sat forwards and adjusted his eyeglasses.
"I see you are quite a young man, sir. Will this have to go to a superior?"
"My superior?"
"Yes, sir. I imagine something this grave."
"My master's name is Hapshant. He is indisposed, an old ailment. I hold the rank of interrogator, as I told you. I can deal with this matter."
"Oh, good. That's good. Very good. So, how will you proceed?"
The officer stared at Master Imus. "Forgive me, Imus. You don't seem alarmed at all by this process."
"Alarmed?"
Imus echoed.
"Of course I'm alarmed. I'm terrified. I've been terrified of this day all my life.
Why?
Because it happens to us all, sooner or later, doesn't it? Every day of my working life I have walked to work up Sarum Street, and come by this place, so dark and unfriendly. I never pass it without a shudder. It is mortality. It is the face that awaits us all should we cross the line. Do you think it was easy coming here today? No, sir. It has taken me a week to find the confidence. This afternoon, as I raised my hand to rap at the door, my courage almost fled. But I am a true citizen of Imperial Hesperus. I am a true son of the Emperor. It was my duty to report this, no matter what fate awaits me.
The officer nodded. The clock ticked. Tell me what you understand by the number of ruin, said the officer. Master Imus sat back and shrugged.
It is an impossible number. An abomination. It is a notation of filthy power. Numbers own power, you see. My father raised me to respect 3 and 7, 13 and the triple sixes, the primes, the constants, but the number of ruin, that is the number of...
Of
the war,
Imus whispered, looking to one side and then the other, as if in fear of being overheard. The officer nodded his head. So Hapshant has taught me. Can you show me the number? Can you write it down?
Are you mad?
This room is warded and I am armed. Can you show me the number? Master Imus took a data slate from his robe pocket. It was battered and worn from use. He activated it and entered a series of digits into the display.
There are the accounts,
he said, pausing before handing the slate over.
I have selected the key section. Please be careful.
The officer held out his hand. Show it to me, please, sir. Master Imus hesitated.
What did you say your name was, young man?
Eisenhorn, the officer replied. Interrogator Eisenhorn of the Emperor's Holy Ordos. Why?
Please be careful with this, Interrogator Eisenhorn.
Master Imus handed the old data slate to the officer. The officer looked at the screen with a slight frown. The gilt clock stopped ticking. A strange silence filled the room. The officer began to say, and caught fire. Blue flames, as hot as a burner torch, consumed his skin and roasted the flesh off his bones until nothing remained except dripping, blackened meat and a charred skull wrenched into a rictus by heat-tightened sinews. The data slate dropped onto the desk from a smoking, skeletal hand with a thump. The officer's clothing was untouched. The flames gutted out, and the scorched corpse slumped forward with a crack of dry ligaments. Imus got up and backed away. His eyes were wide. He fought back a terrible desire to urinate.
Someone,
he murmured.
Someone, anyone, help me.
He reached the door and tried to open it, but it was locked. He knocked on it gingerly, as if hoping someone on the other side might open it without being put to too much trouble. A hand took his arm. Please sit down, Master Imus, the officer said. Master Imus started rather badly, and recoiled with such surprise he banged his elbows and the back of his head against the door. The officer, who was not burned in any way, was standing in front of him. Master Imus. Master Imus began to shake. Then he started to hiccup. He continued to stare at the officer. What did you see? The officer asked.
You were on fire,
replied Master Imus.
You caught fire. The fire burned you until you were dead.
Master Imus? Johann Imus repeated his previous commentary, this time forcing his voice to actually make some sounds. Ah, said the officer. An illusion, that's all. Necessary to the work.
Necessary?
Asked Master Imus.
Necessary how? To what work?
To my work. The officer gestured towards the chair Imus had vacated. He paused. His tone became more sympathetic. I apologize. I have shaken you, haven't I? Master Imus shrugged and managed a small, dry laugh.
Indeed. I have never seen a man combust before. I have never even seen a man die. How was the illusion done? What was the point of frightening me?
The officer's sympathetic air melted. I'm not about to answer any questions, sir. All the questions will be mine. There were a great many of them. They came at Master Imus so rapidly, he became rather flustered. The officer asked him the names of his parents, and his vocation numeral, and inquired of his political leanings. He asked Master Imus to account for his whereabouts on certain dates, stretching back 2 years. He asked if Master Imus could operate a cogitator, if he held keys to the auction house premises, if he had ever been off-world, and where his family originated from. Master Imus attempted to answer as best he could. Sometimes a new question came at him before the last answer had been completely recited. Is there a record of public misdemeanors in your family? How long have you resided at your current address? Can you detail your diet in general terms? Are you receiving Medicaid treatment for any ailment? Have you ever been to Auselberg? How many languages do you speak? How many languages do you read? Do you dream? What do you dream about? How often do you attend Templum services? Have you ever taken the standard Psychana test? Have you ever been in trouble before?
Am I in trouble now?
Asked Master Imus. He was made to wait in the anteroom again. Night had fallen. The lamp, almost out of promethium, fluttered valiantly. The officer came to get him, and led him out into the street. The evening was warm and humid. Master Imus could smell the roasting and poaching and frying underway in the kitchens of the local eating-houses. A few pedestrians passed by along the pavement under the street lamps.
"Where are we going?"
Master Imus asked. "What did I tell you about questions?" the officer asked. Master Imus pursed his lips and shrugged. Two men joined them from the dark building. One was an old shuffling being in long dark robes. The other was a young man, of an age and mode of dress that matched the officer's. This man was more handsome, however, more genial in his countenance. "Is this the fellow?" he asked. The officer nodded. "Let's process this, Gregor," the man requested. "I had plans for tonight." They walked down the street. The officer and the other young man walked on either side of Master Imus, like an escort of jailers, walking a convict to the scaffold. The old, hunched man followed them. "We will inspect your hab," the officer said.
"Of course," said Master Imus. "It's not far."
Master Imus took out his keys and opened the deadbolts of his door, one by one. A baby was crying loudly on the floor below, and the stairwell was pungent with the odor of steamed cabbage. Mistress Elva, from down the landing, came out and made a point of sweeping her front step so she could get a good look at the dark men Master Imus had brought home with him. As Master Imus finished the business of unlocking, the officer's companion turned to look at Mistress Elva. "Are these your eyes, good wife?" he called. "I found them in the back of my head." Mistress Elva bridled and went inside. The young man laughed. "Don't start, Titus," the officer said. The other man leaned against the wall. "Lousy old bitch," he remarked.
48,
said the old man, lurking behind them. 48 what? Asked the officer, turning.
Steps. 2 flights of 24. Asquire spruce, not local. Vitrian glass in the lamp housings, though some of them have been replaced by cheaper alternatives.
And this is pertinent how? Inquired the young man called Titus. The old man shrugged with a bionic hiss.
Oh, it's not.
Master Imus opened the door. He felt rather ashamed of the musty smell that breathed out of the doorway. The officer produced a docket. "Sign this," he told Master Imus.
"What is it?"
"A waiver. Interrogator Endor and I are about to search your residence." Master Imus initialed the docket. The two interrogators entered the hab. Master Imus followed them, and the old man shuffled in behind him. The old man sniffed.
"Sec vinegar," he said.
"What?"
asked Master Imus.
"Sec vinegar and cayleaf."
"I use the vinegar to clean my fingers,"
said Master Imus.
"It's the only thing that gets the ink out."
"The only thing that gets the ink out,"
the old man repeated.
"And I use cayleaf in a paste to re-grind my quills."
"You don't smoke it, then?" asked the old man.
"Smoke it? Why?"
"As a balm against rheumatic inflammation."
"No."
"Ah,"
the old man said. He shuffled forwards into the living room, his legs creaking like a servitor's. He was terribly hunched, and his augmetic eyewear clicked as it hunted.
"You should. It's very medicinal. It would help your hip."
"My hip?"
asked Master Imus.
"You walk with a slight counter-rotation, 2 centimeters short on each right step. You shuffle, sir. I presume it is rheumatism."
Master Imus felt quite dismayed. These three men had intruded into his home. The officer was in his bedroom, overturning the mattress. The other man, Endor, was in the little side kitchen, sniffing the contents of various jars. No one had been inside Master Imus's hab for years. It felt like a violation.
"Are you the Inquisitor?"
Master Imus asked.
"Me? Bless you, no," replied the old man. "Why would you think that?"
"I just assumed."
The old man shuffled over to the sideboard.
"Fuse fit sampwood. No maker's mark. A vase."
He picked the vase up.
"Please be careful,"
Master Imus said. The old man ignored him. He held the vase in his spindly fingers.
"Samitaware, 3rd dynasty.
He looked inside it.
"Oh, paperclips."
The officer came back from the bedroom, holding several books. "You have books," he said.
"Is there something wrong with that?"
asked Master Imus. "You like poetry?"
"The early imperials, the Tacits. Is that a crime?"
"This is," said Endor. He walked in from the side kitchen with something in his hand. There was an ugly, almost triumphant grin on his face. Master Imus realized that what he first registered as handsome in the features of the officer's companion was, in fact, a cruel arrogance. Interrogator Endor was accustomed to winning. "What is it?" asked the officer. "Buried at the bottom of a jar of caffeine," Endor replied. He held out his hand. 6 little pills lay in his palm. "Yellows," he said.
"Most perturbatory," said the old man.
"They're not mine,"
said Master Imus. Master Imus sat on the threadbare couch, tugging at his robe.
"They're not mine. Not mine, not at all. I don't use that sort of thing. I wouldn't even know how to get that sort of thing."
"Zespere Street, or the dealers that frequent the depot," said the old man.
"Be quiet, Amos," said the officer. He stared down at Master Imus. "This is a bad turn of events for you. It compounds things."
"They're not mine. How many times do I have to say it?"
"They were in your kitchen," said Endor, who seemed to be relishing Master Imus's discomfort.
"I didn't put them there."
"Oh, so someone just came in and hid them in your caffeine, did they?"
"That must be it. I can think of no other explanation."
"I've had enough. Let's process him." "Slow down, Titus," said the officer. "He's up to his ears in it." "Slow down," I said. "I had plans for tonight," Titus Endor scowled. "Fantastic for you. Give me the tablets." Endor tipped the yellows into the officer's hand. The officer sat down on the couch next to Master Imus. "Get lost," he told his companions. Endor went out onto the landing to smoke a low stick. The old man shuffled away to examine the books in the bedroom. "I'll be frank. This is going badly for you, sir," the officer explained to Master Imus.
"I realize that."
"The matter of the accounts is the main thing, but the yellows, they complicate the matter."
"I understand."
"They are a prohibited substance, that's the first thing. The second thing is, they're yellows."
"I don't know what you mean,"
said Master Imus. "This isn't the first time I've inspected an individual's hab and found evidence of drug use. Obscura, gladstones, that sort of business. But yellows, they're mind expanders. We typically find them in circumstances connected to cult activity."
"Cult?"
"We often find them used in association with prohibited texts and deviant knowledge. A man who has the number of ruin might use yellows to help him fathom it and master its use." Master Imus put his head in his hands.
"They're not mine."
"Is the Ursaka yours?"
"The what?"
"I found it between the Frobisher and the early Tacits in your bedroom."
"I don't know what an Ursaka is. I don't know its significance."
"It's a prescribed text. It defines the methodological use of psychotropic drugs in gnomic enlightenment." "So that was just placed there too, was it? Someone just put it there?"
"They must have done."
The officer sighed. "Master Imus, you've brought a matter to our attention. A serious matter. The numbers you showed me in the ledger are quite pernicious."
"And I came of my own volition. Remember that."
"I do, and that leaves me with 2 possibilities. You are a practicing heretic with a pathological desire to be caught and condemned."
"Or?"
"Or, Master Imus, you have been set up to take the fall for someone. There's one last thing I would like to do. It's necessary for my work."
"What is it, sir?"
asked Master Imus. The officer turned to look at him. His face was no longer human. It was a snout of rancid, gnashing teeth, spatulate and broad, with sharp edges. The snout opened, drooling spit, and seemed about to bite Master Imus's face clean off. Master Johann Imus smelled the pit stink of the warp, and the shadows of dark places where no human ever willingly walked. He saw a monstrous horror lunging at him, pallid tentacles whipping up out of the distended throat. He cried out in fear, and wet himself.
"I'm sorry I had to do that, Master Imus," said the officer, wiping his mouth. Titus Endor came in from the stairhead.
"Thrown, Gregor. I felt that.
Sorry. Would you and Amos please stay here and tidy the place? And help Master Imus to get cleaned up?"
"I had plans for tonight," replied Endor.
"And now I have plans of my own," said the officer. Titus Endor stayed until midnight, and then made some vague excuse and left. The old man remained with Master Imus until dawn. They played regicide and talked of antiques. The officer returned at first light.
"The matter is settled," he said. "Thank you for your cooperation."
When Master Imus went to work the next day, he found that Slosha and Daviov et C. had been closed down, with immediate effect and until further notice, the seal on the door said. Most of the staff had gathered in the street, bewildered and despondent.
"Master Slosha was shot," muttered one of the underkeepers.
"He was shot last night by the Inquisition," another confirmed.
"Oh, dear,"
said Master Imus. 3 days later, the officer called on Master Imus at his hab.
"Won't you sit down, sir?"
invited Master Imus. "I've come to tell you that you've been formally cleared of all charges," the officer said.
"Even my transgression?"
"Even that."
"I'm very relieved,"
said Master Imus. "Your employer was conducting bad business, heretical business, in fact. He was engaged in the importation of illicit texts under the cover of the auction house's primary dealings. We'd been after him for a year. We had no proof of his activities."
"I see."
"Your employer knew we were on to him, of course. He set you up to act as a distraction. He wanted us to concentrate on you instead of him. And we would have, if you hadn't been so honest as to bring the matter to our attention."
"Did you kill Master Slosha?"
asked Johann Imus. "I'm afraid I did." The officer rose. "Well, I must be on my way."
"What happens now?"
asked Master Imus. "What do you mean?"
"I have no job to go to. The auction house is finished. What will become of me?"
"I'm sorry, sir. That's not my problem." The officer turned to leave.
"I think I might be allowed to ask one question, in all fairness,"
said Master Imus. "Ask it."
"Why was it necessary?"
"Why was what necessary?" asked the officer.
"Why was it necessary to scare me?"
"Fear simplifies the mind, Master Imus. It is so strong and pure, it quite empties the head and removes all barriers and falsehoods. I scared you so I could read the truth inside you, the honest part of you that you could not dissemble. I'm sorry about that."
"You're a psyker, then?"
Master Imus asked.
"Yes."
"Ah, I see. If you can read into the future, tell me. I have no job and no references. I am too old and set in my ways to retrain. I have no means of support. I came forward of my own free volition, helped you hunt out a heretic and proved my innocence, and I am left the poorer for it. What do I do now?"
"I'm a mind reader, not a clairvoyant."
"Right. Thank you for your candor, anyway."
"Goodbye, Master Imus." Interrogator Eisenhorn closed the door behind him. Master Imus sat on the threadbare couch. From the floor below, he could hear a baby crying. He could hear the knock of the landlord, going from hab to hab for the week's rent. Master Imus's rent dues were in the sideboard drawer, this week's and the next's, but nothing more. Master Imus was glad he had come forward, and glad he had spoken out. Duty was duty, after all. He tried to inflate some sense of civic pride in his heart. But he wished, more than anything, he had just kept himself to himself.
That was Master Imus's Transgression, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Regia Occulta, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth.
I crossed over into Gerrard County via the pass at Kulbrech. Air links were down, because of the cackle, So a reluctant motorized unit of the local militia conveyed me from the capital as far as Kulbrecht town, and then only because the Jared commissioner had been so insistent. This was, 223.M41, and I was only just out of my own. Even then, at the very dawn of my career, I was treated with a mixture of fear and suspicion. The rosette, or the title Inquisitor, or a combination of both, fairly focused the minds of those who met me. This attitude bores me these days. Back then, it gave me a sort of vulgar sensation of power. Inquisitor Flamel had been killed 6 months before in a miserable warp transit accident, and I had been posted as a locum to cover his circuit, which was the fief worlds of the Grand Banks in the coreward reaches of the Helican sub. Circuit work is a drudge, and one acts, in the main, as an itinerant magistrate, travelling from planetary capital to planetary capital, reviewing flots and cases gathered by the local authorities. Most are trivial and hardly ordo business, scares conjured up by superstition and petty disputation, though I had spent 8 weeks on New Bylar working through a caseload that eventually exposed a traffic in low-grade, unsanctioned psychers. From New Bylar I went to Ignix, the smallest and most peripheral of the fief colonies, a place locally regarded as the back end of all creation. Ignix did not disappoint. Small, wet, and whirled with ravines and meandering trenches created by an eternity of rainfall, eroding its way down into the frothing seas, the planet is administratively divided into counties, each one millions of square kilometers. Its capital is called Foothold, for it was there the first settlers made planetfall. They were miners, mineral extraction being the only profitable occupation a man can find on Ignix. Not long into their habitation, the miners of Ignix specialized and became wet miners, panning and sifting the planet's thousand fast waterways, many of them temporary runoffs that surge one day and are gone the next, for precious ores. Wet mining fortunes had built Foothold into a decent-sized but drab town. All the worthwhile minerals had been shipped off-world in return for hard cash, and the place had been constructed from the residue. The buildings were stained and grim, many of them fabricated from locally cast rockcrete, or a type of melter-formed pumice brick. I was put up in an airless residentiary, and went to the courthouse every day to review the pending cases. None of them deserved my attention, or even the rubber stamp of the orders. I had been there 4 days when the cackle began. The name is a local one. A more appropriate description would be seasonal electrocorporeal storms, a byproduct of Ignix's orbital variations and the virile behavior of the star it circles. The storms visit each yearly cycle and blanket the northern hemisphere with a steady, florid electromagnetic display. The sky lights up. Corpuscent nests on rooftops and masts. Vox links suffer. There is a continuous sound in the air, like a dry, evil chuckle, hence the name. Some years it's mild, others it's bad. 223 was a bad year. The cackle was so fierce, it prevented any and all passage by air, including shuttle links from the lift harbour to starships at high anchor. Transfers on and off Ignix were suspended, and I was stuck for the duration, which turned out to be 3 weeks. There was some novelty to be enjoyed at first. The flickering lights in the sky, day and night, were quite sublime, and produced certain hues that I swear I have never encountered since. But the constant dirty chuckle became onerous and tormenting, as did the rancid metallic sweat the charged air drew out of me. It was foggy and close, and I quickly wearied of getting shocks from every damn metallic object I touched or used. I came to realize why the late Flamel had made Ignix a low priority on his circuit. With the cases done with, there was little to do but wait for the cackle to subside. I read and studied, and struck up passing friendships with several similarly stranded travellers living in the residentiary, merchants mostly. Perhaps friendships is too strong a word. I knew them well enough to share a drink or a conversation or a game of regicide with, but nothing more. They understood what I was, and it made them nervous around me. For the first time in my career, that vulgar sensation of power began to feel like a burden. Towards the end of the first week of enforced occupation, a message arrived from the commissioner of Jared County. Due to the vox-out, it was brought by a biker who had run the flooding levees and washplains of the county limits overnight. I can only assume the commissioner had paid the man well, for he was in a poor state by the time he arrived. The foothold administrator, an old fellow called Wagner, brought the message slip to me and waited while I read it.
"He seems most insistent, this commissioner," I remarked.
"Miles Elvin, he's a good sort, very dutiful. He knew you were in town on circuit duties, and evidently hopes you might oblige him." I held the slip up.
"Do you think this is genuine, administrator?" I asked.
Wagner shrugged his sloping shoulders.
"Sounds like a hot one to me, but what do I know? I don't have Rosette training."
Zelwyn, the commissioner of Jared County, had reported a pair of killings in his township, the unimaginatively named Jared County Town. He suspected cult activity and requested an assessment by the circuit inquisitor. I would have dismissed it except for two facts. One, I had nothing better to do, and two, Zelwyn had written, "The victim suffered deep, random cuts and slashes to the body, having been slain by a crushing head wound. Each victim was missing its left ear." "How do I get there? Can you scare up a transport for me?" I asked. Wagner laughed at the idea. "In this? All right. I'll see what I can do." The local militia took me overland to the pass in a centaur, hooded against the rain and bulked out with yellow swim bladders to allow for the fording of flash floods. The crew was not at all happy about the outing, but bit their tongues because of what and who I was. After 12 hours grinding along mud tracks and waterlogged gulches, they got me through the pass, over the iron bridge, and into Kulbrecht town. As we crossed the old rusting bridge, I watched the corpuscent crackle and dance across the posts and stanchions. In Kulbrecht town, an odious shanty backwater, transit was arranged to carry me on the next leg of my journey. The centaur turned back to foothold. I went on in a cargo 8 that had seen better days.
"There's been killing, you know," the driver mentioned, conversationally.
I had heard something to that effect. The driver nodded. Tiny threads of static were playing across his knuckles as he nudged the wheel.
4 dead, he said.
I can honestly say that I quite admired Jared Commissioner Maldar Zelwyn. What he lacked in almost everything he made up for in sheer optimism. He showed me around Jared County Town personally, and made it clear he was tremendously proud of it. The town straddled 12 river threads, and it seemed to be all bridges and decking and cantilevered platforms. Habs stacked up high above the steep rain river chutes. Water throbbed and rattled and chugged down the channels through the town on its journey from the hills to the sea. As he drove me across the new bridge, Zelwyn proudly explained how he had seen to its construction 5 years earlier, for the benefit of the community. It was a large metal structure, connecting the commercial quarter to the merchantman residences, and was evidently a boon to working practices. Before the bridge, the merchants had been obliged to take taxi boats from their homes to the commercial every day. The river it crossed was one of the largest and most powerful bisecting Jared County town, and the new bridge was equipped with elevating sections so it could lift to admit the passage of trade ships and other water traffic coming inshore from the coast to the warehouse docks. It was an impressive piece of engineering, lit up, as we rode across it, by the unending light show of the cackle. Zelwyn clearly worked hard to support and improve his community, at the back end of all creation, though it was. We drew up on the glistening wharfs of the commercial and got out of the bulky land car. Zelwyn was a stocky man in his late 40s, with thinning hair and a heavy, bushy moustache. He took a data slate out of his overcoat pocket.
"All the victims were discovered in the commercial district," he told me. "Here's a plan of the locations. It seems arbitrary to me."
I agreed, but I didn't say so. "Is there crime scene data? Forensic material?"
"I'm having it processed for you," he replied.
"And you've got 4 now?"
2 more since I sent my message," he confirmed.
"Is there a pattern?"
"Apart from the way they were killed," he asked,
and shook his head.
"There's no connection between the victims, except for the area they worked in. A trolley pusher, a warehouse man, a junior mercantile clerk, and a whore. We haven't been able to connect any variables. As far as we know, they didn't know each other."
"But you have a theory?" I asked him. He nodded.
"The killer lives somewhere in the commercia."
"Because?"
"Each killing took place at the time when the new bridge was raised. There was no crossing to the merchant district. To me, that says it must be local.
I nodded. But just a regular killer, surely. Not an order matter.
We've had our fair share of murders over the years, Inquisitor,
Zelwyn replied.
My office handles the cases. But this, the random mutilation, the missing ears.
What do you think that signifies? I asked.
Trophy taking? He suggested. Cults do like to take trophies, I understand. Ritual, I suppose. It smacks of ritual.
I reckon it might.
Yeah, I thought so, said Zelwyn.
Why?
You wouldn't be here otherwise.
The cackle grew more fierce as night pushed in. When we left the Commercia, rain was beginning to fall, and sirens hooted, warning that the new bridge was about to raise its hydraulic spans. The river was at flood tide. I reviewed the victims in the frosty twinkle of the town morgue. Preservation methods in Jared County were not ordo standard. The cadavers had been dumped in bulk freezer units and came out on their gurneys caked in frost, their vulnerable tissues blackened and cold-burned.
Sorry, said Zelwyn, watching me work. I wish our facilities could be better.
Forget about it, I replied. I used probes and skewers on the frigid bodies, sampling and measuring. The hacking wounds, some so deep they looked like claw marks, were especially ugly. They smiled like happily parted lips, their mouths full to the brim with frozen black ice.
Cult work, then? He asked, after a few minutes. Have I got a cult here I need to deal with?
No. A hunter, I replied.
A hunter?
I nodded.
What does that mean?
Trophy-taking is a hunter's quirk. An ear, a finger, a lock of hair.
But that's ritual, isn't it?
Zelwyn asked. Hunters have rituals too, I said. He looked downcast.
Not a cult thing, then?
You sound disappointed. The Jared Commissioner managed a weak smile.
Of course not. It's just that I'd hoped I was on the money. I wanted to impress you. If this is simply some nut-job serial, I've wasted your time, and I should have known better.
Not to mention, I added, wickedly, that if this had been cult work, I'd have dealt with it for you. Zelwyn shook his head.
I'm sorry to have cost you a journey, sir, he said.
I felt rather ashamed of my attitude. I put down the probe, wiped frosted blood off my gloved hand, and turned to face him. Look, I've nothing better to do. Let me help you anyway.
You'd do that?
He asked, rather taken aback. Of course. Why not?
Because you're, you know,
an inquisitor. Inquisitors don't like serial killings any more than commissioners do, I said. I have certain skills, Commissioner Zelwyn. I think I can bring this animal down. He smiled. It was the warmest, most genuine thing I'd seen in years. I was just trundling the last corpse back into its freezer when a militia officer came into the morgue and whispered something to Zelwyn. He turned to look at me. I felt his pain. I mean, I actually felt it. The psychic talents that would later serve me and shape my career were still raw and unshaped in those days, but my empathetic function nevertheless resounded at his distress.
While we were busy here, he began.
Talk to me, Zelwyn. He took a deep breath.
While we were fussing around here, there's been another death.
Is the body still in situ? He nodded. Let's see it. We had to wait for 5 minutes while the new bridge lowered its spans to let us cross into the Commercia district. Zelwyn let one of his militiamen drive us. The Jared Commissioner's hands were shaking too much to be trusted. Corpuscent lit up the bridge. The sky made strange colours that twisted and turned. Rain fell. The river below us rushed along, rich in sediment, towards the distant sea. Lana Howie had worked the wharf for 12 years, and was a regular face at the drink stops and taverns along the hem of the Commercia. She'd once been popular, a fast girl with good looks and impressive legs, but the work had taken its toll. In the months before her death, she had earned her income turning tricks for specialist customers, men who were more interested in what she was prepared to do rather than the way she looked. Now, she was dead. Her body lay on the ground floor of a warehouse just off Commercia, Maine. It had been discovered by a night watchman. Slim, too slim, and wearing too much makeup, she lay naked and awkward under the overbright portable lamps.
The blood from the deep slashing incisions had pooled under her in a slick. Her left ear was missing.
"Same as the others," said Zelwyn, shuddering.
"No," I said, crouching beside the body.
"No?"
"No, she's still..." I wanted to say alive, but that would have been wrong. She wasn't alive any more, but she was fresh. Fresh compared to the freezer-burned residue Zelwyn had shown me earlier.
"The hunter again?" Zelwyn asked.
"Looks like it. The ear, you notice?"
"Why do you think it's a hunter, Inquisitor Eisenhorn?"
Zelwyn asked. "The slash wounds," I replied. "You see? So deep. These are the kind of deep cuts that a hunter might administer to accelerate decomposition, a kill he doesn't want, and which he wants to rot away quickly." Zelwyn pursed his lips.
"What are you going to do now, sir?"
"I'm going to ask you and your people to get out of this place. Withdraw to a 60-meter perimeter."
"Why?"
"Don't ask me that, Commissioner."
"I want to stay," said Zelwyn.
"On your own head, then. Get your people out."
Later on in my career, I only ever undertook auto-seances when I had a properly qualified astro-telepath to assist me. Such acts can take a toll. Back then, I was young and headstrong and full of my own energy and will. It's a wonder I ever survived. "Bolt the door," I said to Zelwyn. He obliged. His men had gone. "Do what I say and don't interrupt me," I added.
"Right," he said.
He stood back, near the heavy warehouse door, watching. I knelt beside the hacked corpse and sighed. Outside, the cackle sputtered and pulsed.
"Lana Howie?" I called softly. I felt Zelwyn open his mouth to ask why in the name of the throne I was talking to a dead body. I think it was about then that he finally woke up to what was going on. I sensed fear bubbling up inside him, along with a strong desire to be outside with his men after all. He'd never seen anything like this done before.
"Lana Howie?" The warehouse air took on the glossy, cold feel of hyper-reality. The light refined in clarity, and small details became impossibly sharp. The various odors of the place—soot, rockcrete, oil, sacking, thinners, and the body itself—were suddenly more concentrated, more pronounced.
"What am I doing here?"
asked the late Lana Howie. I heard Commissioner Zelwyn groan. I felt his gnawing fear.
"Lana Howie," I called.
"Hello, mister. What's your pleasure, then, sir?"
"Lana, my name is Gregor."
"That's a lovely name, Gregor. You're a handsome one for sure, Gregor. What can I do for you tonight?"
"Where are you, Lana Howie?"
"I'm in the warehouse with you, silly man. This is my place. Don't you fret. It's quiet here, discreet. You're a regular, aren't you? I know your face."
"You've never seen me before, Lana Howie. You'll never see me again."
"I doubt that," she sniggered.
Her chuckle was the scratchy glee of the cackle.
"I'll bet you'll be back again for more, soon enough."
"I need you to focus, Lana Howie," I said.
"Focus? What? Why do you keep using my name, my whole name, like that? Is that your thing, mister?"
"Lana?" I felt Zelwyn fighting back an urge to throw open the door bolts and run. I really hadn't wanted him to be here in the first place. All he could see was me kneeling beside the body. He could not see what I could see. An after-image of the victim had appeared to me. She was wearing a cheap, revealing dress, and had taken a seat on a nearby freight trunk, one leg crossed over the other. The raised foot was swinging impatiently.
"Lana, can you hear me?" "How do you know my name, mister?"
the image asked, watching me.
"Administratum files."
"Lana, who was it?"
"Who was it that what? Come on, I've got punters waiting. What are you on about?"
"Lana, please, let me see. Who did this to you?"
"Who did what to me? Look, I haven't got all night," she breathed. "Show me some money, mister."
I reached into my pocket and produced 3 crowns. The air was very cold. My breath was steaming, and so were the open wounds on the corpse in front of me. On the trunk, Image Lana swung her leg.
"That'll do it," she said. "What do you want? Full service? All the stuff?"
She stood up abruptly and reached down to pull her dress off over her head. It was only then that she seemed to notice the body on the floor. The image stared down at it for a long time, her hands frozen in the act of bunching up her dress to drag it over and off. When she looked at me again, her eye makeup was blotted and running.
When? She asked.
Not long ago.
Oh, Throne, what did I ever do to deserve that?
Nothing, Lana. I want to know who it was. Will you show me?
She showed me. She showed me, her voice growing steadily quieter and quieter, and when she was done, she faded altogether without any protest, casting me one last hurt look with her makeup-stained eyes. I took off my storm coat and laid it over the corpse. Outside, dawn was no more than an hour away. The rain had eased off, and the cackle had dropped in intensity. Zelwyn stood by the waiting militia transports, taking repeated draws from an old hip flask. When I walked up, he offered it to me. I took a big swallow.
"Are you?"
he began. "I need a moment." The work had drained me, not so much sapping my will as abrading my emotions.
"Can the details move in at last?"
he asked. I nodded. Several militia officers and two coroners with a stretcher went into the warehouse at Zelwyn's nod. After a few minutes, someone brought me my coat. I gestured to Zelwyn and walked away in the direction of the new bridge. "It's a good thing I stayed," I told him. "This turns out to be an Ordo matter after all."
"A cult?"
"No, and not a hunter either. At least, it could be either of those things, but that's not what makes it an Ordo matter. We're dealing with a Regia Occulta."
"Hidden way," he translated.
Zelwyn was no fool. He had high Gothic. That's the literal translation. In the Ordo Malleus, it has a more specific meaning.
Go on.
A Regia Occulta is a pathway, a tunnel or portal, if you like, that links our reality with that of the warp.
Is it a deliberate thing?
He asked. Perhaps. Cults and heretics do sometimes open them deliberately. But it could be a natural occurrence. Most are. The fabric of space is thin in places, you see, and sometimes there are leaks. He shook his head, and a sad smile appeared under his heavy moustache.
"I don't actually know much about the warp, sir," he said.
"Nor should you, Commissioner. It's forbidden law. I'm just telling you what you need to know. There is a Regia Occulta in Jarrett County Town, and it's right here." We were standing at the commercial end of the new bridge. It took Zelwyn just a few minutes to have the bridge and its feeder roads closed off and barricaded by the militia. Another hour, and it would have been teeming with traffic heading in for work.
"Can you tell me why this only happens when the bridge is up?" Zelwyn asked. "I mean, surely that would block a crossing."
"I'll do better than tell you," I said. "I'll show you." We took up a position at the commercial end, me, Zelwyn, and four men from the militia, armed with powerful auto-rifles. At my nod, the commissioner signaled to the bridge machine room on the far bank, and the operators engaged the hydraulics. Ponderously, with a dull squeal like gates opening, the massive spans began to lift. The cackle fluoresced in the dawn sky over our heads. Blue ropes of fizzling corpuscent writhed and trickled like snakes around the iron finials of the bridge towers, and traced their way along the rising edges of the gigantic metal spans. The hydraulics cut out when the spans were at a standard lifted position, at about 40 degrees from the horizontal. We waited, looking up the steep metal slope of the span facing us. Below us, out of sight, the fast-running river gurgled, hissed. We waited for 10 minutes. Corpuscent gathered in increasingly heavy ribbons around the raised tips of the bridge span, as if attracted there in concentration, like lightning drawn to a conductor. There was a dry, electric crack, and we smelled ozone. One of the militiamen pointed. A whip of corpuscent had flicked out from the tip of one span and connected with the tip of the other, like a squiggle of electrostatic voltage crackling between two insulated orbs. It remained there, jerking and sizzling, like a bright twisting rope tying the two halves of the raised bridge together. This feature had not been evident in the patchy disposition Lana Howie had shown me, but I suddenly felt I had discerned the key mechanism of the infernal Regia Occulta. One of the militiamen started to say something, but I already knew it was happening. The hairs on my neck were raised. I felt something akin to a ball of ice in my stomach, and a searing pain behind my eyes. The killer came into view. He simply manifested out of nowhere, as if the air had parted like a curtain and let him through. He appeared high up on the span ahead of us and began to plod down the steep slope. He did not see us at first. We heard his feet slapping heavily on the metal roadway. Though humanoid, he wasn't human. I was the largest man in our party, and he was twice my mass and half my height again. He came wrapped in a heavy, ragged cloak of animal skins, with a hood drawn up. His shoulders were very broad. The pain behind my eyes was getting worse by the second. I could barely focus. "Kill it," I said. We opened fire. 4 military-grade auto-rifles, firing reinforced rounds with 50% more grain in them than standard. Zelwyn's las gun and my Transvasa assault pistol. The noise was stunning, and the muzzle flash a strobing flutter. The killer was dead in just a few seconds. Our firepower tore him apart and shredded his foul cloak, though he possessed such astonishing strength that he actually managed to walk into our fuselage a step or two, trying to shrug it off before it overcame him. He fell heavily and rolled down the slope. He was a mature orc warrior. Released by his spasming paws, a huge cleaver and a large metal cudgel lay on the roadway beside him. We approached slowly. Greenskins are notoriously hard to kill, and though we had blown this one wide open, I fired 3 more rounds into its skull to be on the safe side. Ikor, almost black in the dawn light, ran down the slope. The mangled corpse showed signs of body paint, tribal markings, and lots of crude piercings and bangles. Fresh human ears were strung round its throat on a wire.
"A greenskin," Zelwyn murmured. "But this isn't green space. There haven't been any orcs in this sub for generations."
"It didn't come from this sub," I said. I was finding it hard to speak or concentrate. The pain behind my eyes was even worse than before. It felt like a hot wire. "It came from whatever random site this Regia Occulta connects to. This beast went hunting one day and ended up here. We'll never know. I fancy where...
Inquisitor. Inquisitor Eisenhorn," I heard Zelwyn say.
I felt his hand catch my arm. The pain behind my eyes had turned into full-blown psych agony. I could barely stand, let alone speak. And I really wanted to speak. I needed to. I needed to yell out, "It's not over!" The Regia Occulta was still open. While we had been standing there, gawping at the orc's cadaver, a second one had walked in through the hidden way. For such a massive thing, it moved very fast. I moved like lead, transfixed by the pain the seething warp gate was lancing into my receptive mind. I heard a feral roar and smelled a foul animal scent. I fell, shoved aside, I think. An auto rifle fired. The orc slew the first militiaman as he landed among us, splitting the fellow straight through the crown with his jagged cleaver. The man collapsed under the force of the blow, his sectioned skull spilling open as the blade jerked back out, his heels drumming the ground. The orc caught another man by the throat, yanked him off his feet, and bit away his face. It is awful to reflect that this unfortunate lived for at least another 10 minutes. The orc broke the back of a third militiaman with a stinging cudgel blow, before making off in great bounding leaps towards the unlit buildings of the Commercia. Zelwyn and the sole remaining militiaman fired after it. The man with the broken back lay on the ground, screaming.
"Eisenhorn!" Zelwyn yelled. "Lower the bridge."
I didn't want to use my will on the poor fellow, but I had no choice. My mouth wouldn't work. Zelwyn wet himself as my mind intruded upon his. To his credit, he rallied and signaled the machine room. The new bridge slowly rattled and clanked back into place. The corpuscent charge between the spans shorted out and vanished as the opposite ends touched. My mind cleared at once, the pain draining back. The Regia Occulta was shut. Blood had streamed out of my nose and soaked the front of my jacket. I got up and ran towards the warehouses. The orc had vanished from sight. I had to find it before it found anyone else. A greenskin is dangerous enough. This one was enraged, possibly wounded, and knew it was cut off and pursued by its mortal foe, man. Zelwyn ran after me. The remaining militiaman stayed put, too shocked to move, his rifle limp in his white-knuckled hands. "Get back, Zelwyn!" I shouted. "Gather your militia in full force!" "Like hell!" he yelled back. He shouted over at the units waiting behind the barricades, and they moved forwards after us. We entered the most likely venue, a warehouse stacked with mineral hoppers. Glow globes hung from the rafters, but not all of them worked. Frail daybreak glimmered through the roof lights.
"In here,"
Zelwyn whispered, panting. I held up my hand for hush. The place was quiet, except for the mocking chuckle of the cackle. I tried to reach out with my mind, but I was drained, and no human psyker can read the greenskin mind. They are blunt to us. I took a deep breath instead and smelled the air. Mineral stink, wet rocks, and a hint, just a hint, of animal odor. We edged forwards. I saw dark, wet spots on the rock-crete floor, leading between the piled hoppers. Unless someone had recently carried a leaky promethium drum through the place, Zelwyn had managed to wound the creature right enough. I touched one of the spots. It oozed warmth.
"It's here,"
I whispered. Zelwyn already knew that. It had come out of the shadows, nightmarishly silent for something so big, and seized him by the throat. I turned slowly. The orc had pulled the Jared Commissioner in against its massive chest, like a mother hugging a baby to its breast. Its left paw entirely encircled the man's neck. Zelwyn's eyes were wide, and his face was pale. The orc raised its right hand and gently rested the massive cleaver on Zelwyn's scalp. Tiny trickles of blood ran down Zelwyn's face. The bull orc's yellow eyes, deep in the brow-ridged sockets, glared at me. Its heavy, flaccid lips wrinkled and twitched. Its tongue, huge and greasy, worked behind its rotting peg teeth. Each one of those teeth was the size of my palm. The orc was not a bright beast, but it was smart enough, instinctive enough, to recognize its predicament. It was bargaining with me. A life for a life, this much I knew. Otherwise, Zelwyn would have been dead already. I thought about taking a shot, but dared not risk hitting the commissioner. I was too spent, and it was no time to try my aim. Besides, greenskins are notoriously hard to kill. Even if I hit it, one round from a transvasor would not do the trick. All I had was my will. I couldn't impel the orc in any way, but Zelwyn was a different matter. Without hesitation, I reached into the commissioner's panicking mind. He was still clutching his las pistol, dangling at his side. I squeezed his finger for him. The greenskin convulsed in pain, but I already had a grip on Zelwyn's motor function, and I threw him forwards. I felt his astonishment as his body acted without his permission. He flew out of the orc's briefly weakened grip so fast and hard, he careered forwards and bounced face first off the hopper to my right. I was already firing, my weapon braced in a two-handed grip. I emptied the assault pistol's clip into the greenskin's chest, filling the air with drenching black mist and driving the monster into the stack of mineral hoppers behind it. It smashed heavily into the metal siding, but remained on its feet. I ejected the dead clip and let it drop and clatter to the floor as I snapped home a reload from my coat pocket. I tore off the second clip in one go, firing into the orc's face and neck. The back of its vast skull banged repeatedly against the hopper behind it. Spray patterns of ichor splashed out across the hopper's side. It swayed, then took another step towards me. "Oh, for throne's sake," I hissed. "Just die!" It died. The stack of hoppers, unsettled by the repeated impacts, creaked and toppled, crushing the orc in an avalanche of rock ore, clinker, and iron crates. The noise was deafening. I shielded my face. Dust billowed up and slowly settled. I helped the Jared Commissioner to his feet. He was quaking badly. Both of us were coated with a film of rock dust. He looked at the mangled heap of wreckage where dark, clotted ichor seeped out from under the heaps of spoil.
"Holy shit," he murmured.
There was no way, or no way in the understanding of the Ordos anyway, to close a Regia Occulta. I made it quite clear to Zelwyn that the new bridge should never, ever be raised again, for it was that very raising during the cackle that produced the unique combination of effects necessary for the Regia Occulta to function. He needed no persuasion. The day before I left Jared County Town, he had the machine room dismantled and the heavy gauge hydraulics uncoupled. I understand, though I cannot confirm the fact, that the new bridge was swept away in a freak flood tide some years later. It was never replaced. The Regia Occulta never reoccurred in Jared County Town. Commissioner Zelwyn, who went on to serve his community for 6.5 decades, kept one of the orc cleavers on his office wall, and enjoyed telling visitors that the dried blood on its points was his. The morning I left, he came to see me off. "I hope I never see you again, Inquisitor," he said, shaking my hand. "I hope so too, Commissioner." He paused. "I meant that in a good way," he added. "So did I," I said. I crossed over into Foothold County via the pass at Kulbrech. The reluctant motorized unit of the local militia were there to meet me, the engine of the Centaur idling. They weren't glad to see me, but I was glad to see them. The